That's part of what makes prophecy interesting. It's not just about seeing the future. There's something of a propaganda also in prophecy, or what I like to call propaganda, that people try to make a future, or they try to change a future from happening, like a lot of people did during the Y2K experience, which I go into in depth because I was one of the voices out there in the 1990s that, when it wasn't so popular to talk about it, was saying, hey, we've got this problem with the computers switching up years to the years of 00, because that means in computer language a mixed message that, oh, should I go to a new century or should I shut down?
Exactly.
So,
and that was a real possibility.
Yeah, it was. I went and researched, and there were a number of things that happened, despite the fact that in the last 5 years or so, people began to take it seriously and make the simple, though, you know, very busy job of going through every computer and switching over. Of course, I felt rather satisfied and a bit smug because I've been an Apple user all my life, so, and Steve Jobs had already anticipated that issue. But since most of the world was on PC, it was not anticipated because, you know, we never thought about a century ending in zeros, or we just grew up with 19 being next to every year, and then it became 20. So, but that was an example of what I cite as I think maybe even just recently there was a rerun of one of my shows I did with Art back in early 2000 where we talked about this, I think, just a few days ago.
Yeah, one of our Somewhere in Times, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that was the first time, I think it was the 4th of January, 2000, four days after the turn of the century, where I basically declared that, you know, this is a prophetic success story. The Y2K bug is just the kind of prophecy that I like to see happen and be involved with. And it's what I call in the book, you know, kind of a fictional story about some 16th century village idiot who's rocking and rolling back and forth on the rail of a fence and foams at the mouth suddenly and falls over, and everybody in the village gathers around, and he makes this very persuasive argument in his prophetic scotoma of experience that you've got to do this, this, and that, or else that something terrible is going to happen to the village. Everybody's convinced. They run off and do the things they need to do, and nothing happens. And so again and again, he keeps making these amazing prophecies. Everybody is compelled by what he has to say to change what they're doing, and nothing happens until someday somebody comes up to him and says, well, none of your prophecies ever come true. So how do you explain that? And he just rock and roll on his rail and say, well, that's because I'm the most successful prophecy in history, a prophet in history. If you want to find a failed prophet, just go next door to the next village and talk to Nostradamus. And, you know, the problem with Nostradamus is that he's world famous because everybody, the few people that anticipate what he's talking about, me being one of them, over the last 4.5 centuries, are not usually heeded by the powers that be, and things happen that people go, oh, yeah, you know, Nostradamus predicted that. But, you know, the worst thing you can be is not a prophet who makes a mistake and doesn't come true, but the worst is a prophet that foresees dire consequences in the future that nobody heeds.
Why is prophecy, John, always upheaval, always chaos, always a calamity? Why doesn't prophecy say things are going to be great and this is super and you're going to have a bright future?
Well, the funny thing is, George, there is a lot of prophecy like that that says that. I'm documented in my 19 books making a lot of very positive prophecies about the future. The problem is not so much in is prophecy dire. It's more in the audience, the human race that seeks to find out about the future is often fixated on the negative.
Yeah, that's true. That is true.
And in a way, it's self-fulfilling. Here again, once again, the prophecy is half propagation. You know, when I'm on your show and I make a prediction, millions of people are listening to it, and it's very possible that you have many millions of chances now for what I predict not to happen. Give a great example. When I was talking so much about the rise of Hillary Clinton as a potential presidential candidate, I know from my letters that inspired a whole lot of people to vote against her. So,
you changed prophecy.
Yeah, you do, especially in modern times, in our wired world and the internet revolution. Prophecy is no longer simply an art or a mystery or a skullduggery of predicting the future. It's become a way of shaping the future much more than it ever was in Nostradamus' time.
And I thought she was a slam dunk at that time.
Well, I did too, but in March of 2007, when I began writing articles about her and Barack Obama, who they were still a year out from a political, the famous political campaign,
right,
knockdown dragout that they had in the Democrat primaries, it's on at HogueProphecy.com documented that back in 7th of March, I did an article called Hillary's Albatross. And it looked at there was just one kink in that future that might see her not achieve her destiny, and that is if she could not find a way to explain why she voted for going to war with Iraq with other senators. Mm-hmm. And in a very tight race, I expected, with Barack Obama, the war vote would be the deciding factor of more liberal Democrats, anti-war Democrats, siding with Obama just enough to have her win and lose in a very tight race with Obama. And that did happen. You see, the problem with prophecy, too, is it's very easy to get, as a person involved in prophecy, to say, this is what's going to happen. But really, the more responsible thing to say is, this is the trend. This is the potential that people at this moment are feeding the most with their actions or inactions. And there again, if you're saying it to millions of people as a voice piece for the future, you are already affecting the potential of what people in the present are going to do. They'll either increase what they're doing more or less, and in some way alter the future.
How did you end up keying in on Nostradamus as opposed to an Edgar Cayce or someone else?
Well, it's funny about Nostradamus. I was in junior high school on a lazy afternoon in science class, and I remember the first moment I ever heard that very strange name. I was dozing. It was just before we were going to see a documentary called The Crooked Cross, which opened with the Nazi brown shirts and students throwing bucket loads of books into a blazing fire. And there was this fellow, was it the voiceover of the documentary, saying, over 400 years ago, a man named Nostradamus. And I heard that name, and it made my spine straighten, and suddenly I was wide awake. You know, I didn't know why, even. It was my first reaction, my first impulsive reaction in my life of being involved with this strange man, has often defined a lot of my life, at least to the public at large, was that was the strangest name I'd ever heard, and never heard of that kind of name before. And then the commenter went on to talk about how this French prophet had foreseen a man named Hister, mm-hmm, and who would have a sign of the crooked cross that would do the thing that the children of Germany, which this documentary was showing, just throwing all the great writers into the flames, the children of Germany would know no law, which is the prophecy of Nostradamus about this. And so they used that as kind of a mood setter for a look at the rise of Nazi Germany. What's intriguing later that I found out is one of the books that was being thrown, volumes of it being thrown in those fires, was Heinrich Heine's books. And he also, as a Jewish German of the 19th century, made a very interesting prophecy foreseeing Hitler. He said, the day when Germans start burning books, it will not be much longer afterwards that they will burn people.